Story time now. This is a story about a great loss in our family. This is Mort d'Arthur. It was a summer evening. Heat of the day was done, but night was nowhere in sight. It was that lovely time between time. It was dusk. Everything was faded. It was as if the world had been stonewashed. Dave was driving through the countryside, around the long corners, over the low hills. "Corn's up nice," he said. No one said anything. No one had said anything for half an hour. No one was Stephanie, sitting in the front seat beside Dave, but staring out the side window, away from him. And Sam, sitting in the back. Dave shrugged and fumbled with the button on his armrest. 5 minutes quiet, 10. Dave started to sing quietly, "Twilight Time." Then Stephanie said, "I can't stop thinking about Arthur." "Me too," said Dave. "Me too." Dave's dog, Arthur, was sick. They weren't sure how sick. "Is he going to die?" said Sam. "We don't know," said Dave. We just don't know." "If we don't know," said Stephanie, "why did you come and get me?" "Good question," thought Dave. "I just thought you should see him," he said. "So he is going to die," said Stephanie. "We don't know that," said Dave. But he was going to die. If not now, soon, they all knew that. That's why all the quiet. He was old, and now he was old and sick. They rolled along quietly until a little later when Dave said something under his breath. "What?" said Sam. Dave said, "Oh, I was just thinking about my old dog." Sam said, "How did he die?" Dave said, "I wasn't there, I was away. Scout, a mutt, black and white coat, strong legs, built for running, probably had some border collie in him, the loyalty and the focus, but not the brains." Definitely not the brains. Scout was one dumb dog. "He was one dumb dog," said Dave. This was back when Dave was a boy and living in Big Narrows, back when people built their own homes. You'd start with a basement and live in the basement until you could afford to go higher. Scout, born in some basement, always stayed close to the ground. Scout hated water, which drove Dave's dad, Charlie, a duck hunter, to distraction. "Dog should know how to swim," he'd say every year as duck season approached. One spring, he decided to do something about that. They drove to town, and Charlie threw Scout off the government pier. He sank like a stone. He didn't even try. He went straight down until he reached a point of stasis about 3 feet below the surface, and he hovered there looking up at them sorrowfully. "Oh, no," said Charlie, down on his knees, peering into the water, calling the dog. Scout's mouth appeared to be opening and closing. Looked like he was barking underwater. "Oh, no," said Charlie again. Dave and his sister Annie were both there, standing right beside their dad, pointing and crying, and there was nothing for Charlie to do but stand up, yank off his jacket, and jump in. This was Mother's Day weekend, Broad Oar Lake, in May. Not even the teenagers were thinking of swimming. When Charlie hit the water, he gasped. He almost sank himself. When he told the story later, that's the part he'd start with. "It was close, I'll tell you." And that's just when he hit the water. He knew it was going to be colder below the surface. But he couldn't let the dog drown, not with the kids standing there bawling their eyes out, not with witnesses. So Charlie sucked in a lung full of air, ducked under, grabbed Scout by the tail, and swum him over to the beach. So he saved him, said Sam. The sun was pretty much gone now. Night was settling on the car. The darkness that was obscuring the world was working them together. This was the way Dave had hoped it would be. The three of them driving along, talking as they went. Scout was a small town dog. There was plenty for him to do there. He had a full life. Mostly he hung around with the other dogs and barked. Mostly they did that back at Kerrigan's grocery store. On a good day, the butcher would slip someone a bone, and then there'd be a good fight to see who got it. Sometimes one of them would slip into the store and grab meat right off the counter. Not Scout. But there were dogs in town who would do that. There were dogs who believed in invisibility. They figured if they were fast enough, even if they were seen, no one would recognize them. Did I ever tell you about the day he went to church, said Dave. Stephanie rolled her eyes. Dave wasn't fussed by that. He knew he had told her before. He knew what he was doing. You have to tell stories over and over. It's the creation of myth, the only road to immortality. Tell it, said Sam. Of all the things he did, said Dave, this was probably the best. By the best, he meant the worst. It was summer, said Dave. We were driving our mother crazy. Sam said, who? Dave said, me and Annie, your Aunt Annie, said Dave. And then he said, so my mother decided that on Sundays, everyone was going to go to church, except her. So she could stay home and have time alone. So Sunday mornings, they'd all set off. Charlie took his truck, but Dave and Annie walked. They followed the railway tracks into town where they'd pool their money and buy a pop or a box of chips, then head out of town over the bridge and up the hill to the church. We'd head out around 9 for the 11 o'clock service, said Dave. The Sunday he was telling them about, the famous Sunday, they got to town and there was Scout in front of the Maple Leaf Cafe. He had his nose in a French fry box. Scout, covered in ketchup. Moment he spotted Dave and Annie, Scout decided he was going to go with them wherever it was they were going. Probably because church was in the same general direction as the trout pond. And you never knew, there could be fish heads involved. Dave and Annie knew letting Scout follow them to church was not a good idea. So we stood there, said Dave, and told Scout to go home. And did he go, said Sam? Of course not, said Dave. He followed them, said Stephanie. But not on the road, said Dave. In the woods, paralleling the road. He'd been hanging around bad company. He figured we couldn't see him. When we got to the bridge, said Dave, we stopped and called him. Come here, boy, come on. Come on, Scout. And then what, said Sam. Then we threw stuff at him, said Dave. Sand and stones. They made it up the church hill just in time. The church bell ringing and no Scout in sight. Though I did have a bad feeling, said Dave. Charlie was already there. They slipped into the pew beside him. Now, Charlie went to church for the same reason they did, because Margaret told him to. And he made no bones about it. He had cut articles out of the Reader's Digest and slipped them into the hymnal and read for most of the service. He'd look up occasionally and mutter unhelpful things like, Father O'Neill is climbing new heights on Mount Monotony today. Anyway, said Dave, the three of us were sitting right near the front when they heard this murmur from the back of the church, and Annie, who was on the aisle, turned around and said, don't look now. It was Scout, said Sam. That's right, said Dave, but I couldn't see him. Scout, who had finally arrived at church, had decided he would sneak up to the front to join Dave and Annie. So he had slid under the back pew and was now worming his way forward, row by row. Invisibly. Or so he believed. Sadly, on his way through the woods, Scout had managed to pick up a stick. The stick was attached to his undercarriage and dragging along behind him. Along with some other stuff, some coral-colored muck, stuff he had rolled in and was matted in his fur, and something horrible and foul-smelling. It was hot in church that July afternoon. A heavy sense of torpor had settled on the congregation, and Father O'Neill, who was about to begin his homily, could sense he was losing everyone. He'd been watching Valentine Kavanaugh. Valentine had been fighting off sleep for a good 10 minutes, his head drifting towards his chest and then snapping back as if he'd been shot. But now he had given in. Valentine's head was hanging lifelessly from his neck, and he was snoring softly. Father O'Neill was just coming to the part where the Israelites were punished for speaking out against God and Moses, and in a desperate attempt to wake Valentine from his siesta and get the attention of everyone else, Father O'Neill slammed his hand down on the pulpit and bellowed, "The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many died." And that is when Scout popped up under Valentine's pew. And he nuzzled old Valentine's hand with his ketchup-covered snout. And Valentine, who had been dreaming about biting serpents, blinked one eye open. And there was Scout grinning up at him. He had no doubt that Scout was a serpent. When Scout licked his hand, Valentine lurched out of his seat and screamed, "Jesus, save me!" And Scout dove under the next pew and came up like an apparition between Lillian McAllister's outstretched legs. She saw him and promptly fainted. It was the widow McCoy who stood up and called out, "There are serpents among us!" And Father O'Neill leaned forward to see the serpents for himself, and he knocked the pulpit over. As it went down, he caught a glimpse of Scout and said, "Dear God, serpents!" And that was more or less the end of the service. Scout came right up to us, said Dave. His tail was wagging and he looked at us as if to say, "Isn't church great?" "But how did he die?" said Sam. "Oh," said Dave. And now it was his turn to be silent. "I was away," he said finally. "He was hit by a car." "And he was killed?" said Sam. "No," said Dave, "he made it home. He died a couple of days later. I've always felt bad that I didn't go home and you know, see him." "Why didn't you?" said Stephanie. "Well, I was working and, you know, I figured if he made it home, he was going to be all right." And then he said, "No one said I should. Go home, I mean." 15 minutes later, he pulled into a general store in the middle of nowhere. They parked beside a phone booth under the yellow glow of a street lamp. They went in and got popsicles and a bag of chips. When they got back on the highway, they were quiet again. But it was a different kind of quiet, a together sort of quiet, not an apart one. Sam said, "Tell the one about Arthur and the potatoes." "He used to sit on potatoes," said Dave. "Like he was trying to hatch them," said Sam. "If we wanted to cook potatoes, we had to pull them out from under him," said Dave. Stephanie said, "That is so gross." "And sleeping on the vent," said Sam. In our bedroom, said Dave, Mom and I froze one whole winter because he was sucking up all the heat. And you couldn't figure it out, said Sam. We bought the furnace guy in, said Dave. Twice, said Sam. Cost over $100. And it was me who figured it out. That's right, said Dave. And the ice cream, said Sam. He was crazy for ice cream, said Dave. Is, said Stephanie. He is crazy for ice cream. It was after 10 when they got to town. They drove by the vet's, but the vet was closed. So they went home, and when they got there, Morley was in the kitchen. When she saw Stephanie, she smiled, but only for a second. She smiled, and Stephanie smiled, and then one of them started to cry, and pretty soon they were all crying. The vet called, said Morley. He didn't make it. He went to sleep and didn't wake up. And they stood there, the four of them in the kitchen, Arthur's empty basket by the back door. We do this thing. We open our hearts to the world around us. And the more we do that, the more we allow ourselves to love, the more we're bound to find ourselves one day like Dave and Morley and Stephanie and Sam, standing in the kitchen of our life, surrounded by the ones we love and feeling empty. Empty and alone and sad and lost for words because one of our loved ones who should be there is missing. A mother, a father, a brother, a sister, a wife, a husband, or a dog or a cat. Doesn't really matter. After a while, each death feels like all the deaths. And you stand there like everyone else has stood there before you while the big wind of sadness blows around and through you. He was a great dog, said Dave. Yes, said Morley, he was a great dog. When he was a puppy, Arthur was allowed to sleep on Dave and Morley's bed. When he got bigger, they tried to move him onto the floor and found they had a battle on their hands. No dog in the world was more determined or skilled at insinuating himself on a bed than Arthur. They bought him a basket and put it in the hall just outside the bedroom door. And Arthur would make a big deal of climbing into his basket every night, circling it neurotically, sighing and grunting as he tried to get his blanket into a pleasing hump. But as soon as Dave and Morley were breathing rhythmically, Arthur's head would rise like a periscope. And he would slide over the edge of his basket and work his way into the bedroom, keeping low to the ground, as if he were hunting. He'd stop a foot short of the bed and cock an ear. If he didn't like the way one of them was breathing, he would bring his face close to theirs and listen. Sometimes for 5 or 10 minutes, staring at them like a priest taking confession. His wet nose only inches away from their faces. One night, Dave woke up when Arthur was in the middle of a reconnaissance. And when he opened his eyes, all he could see were two huge eyeballs glaring back at him. Dave had no idea these were Arthur's eyeballs he was looking into. Then Arthur exhaled. And Dave was enveloped by the sour smell of his dog's breath. It was like the breath of death, and he jerked upright. He woke Morley with his gasp. Arthur bounded back to his basket. When Morley opened her eyes, Dave was pointing at the bedroom door. A serpent, he said. Arthur was in his basket snoring, pretending to snore. If, however, when he crept into their bedroom, Arthur was satisfied that Dave and Morley were sound asleep, he would lift one paw slowly onto the bed, and he'd place it there without moving another muscle. If neither of them stirred, the other paw would go up just as slow. And then, rising like a mummy rising from a swamp, Arthur would pull his body onto the bed and settle near their feet with a sigh, taking at first as little space as possible, but slowly unfolding, expanding as the night wore on, as if he were being inflated. He liked to work his body between theirs on his way towards the pillow. He stole my heart, said Dave, over and over again. I'm going to miss him. The walks, just having him around, you know. Me too, said Morley. I'm so glad we had him with us. Have, said Sam. Have him with us. And Sam got up from the kitchen table, and he walked over to the cupboard, and he got a potato. And without a word, he walked over and dropped it into Arthur's basket. He's still here, he said. He always will be.
That was the story we call Mort d'Arthur.